mountains, deserts and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. This article is from the February 1940 issue and is entitled Early Days in Mining Town of Charleston. Text by James G. Wolfe as told to Edward J. Kelly. On the second day of my arrival at Charleston, I entered a saloon to get a drink. The faro dealer was having an argument with a customer concerning a bet. The customer went out. The faro dealer sat down at the end of the bar and began to read a newspaper. As I finished my drink, I heard someone outside approaching the doorway to enter. The faro dealer had tilted back his chair and raised his feet to the bar. Suddenly, though sitting in this awkward position, he reached into his belt with his right hand, pulled out a .45, and dotted the newcomer between the eyes just as that person arrived in front of the open doorway. The dead man was the argumentative customer of only a few minutes before. He had gone to his room for his gun. Without getting out of his chair, the faro dealer calmly went on reading what he had held in his left hand as he shot with his right. Experience and instinct had told him that the man was coming back for trouble. It was simply part of his day's work to get in the first shot. The only thing that annoyed him was the smoke from his own gun barrel. I was scared out of my senses. In one leap, I got outside and made a beeline for my room where I locked the door. I was still there a few hours later when a couple of deputy sheriffs came to get my version of the shooting. At first, I would not unlock the door even for them. As I was a newcomer, they felt I would be an impartial witness as I was not allied with any of the cliques of the town. On learning from me the dead man had a gun on him when he came back, they dropped the case right there. They did not even arrest the faro dealer. I was born on Clinch Mountain, 20 miles east of Morristown, Tennessee, in 1856. When 25 years of age, I came to Hackberry, Arizona, to help build the railroad, but was soon stricken with smallpox, which was then quite common, and returned to Missouri. It was very cold in Missouri in the spring of 1882, so when an old pal wrote me from Charleston, Arizona, that he could guarantee me a job, and the climate was so warm you could sleep without blankets, I started west and reached Charleston in July 1882. The railroad had been only recently built, and I traveled all the way by train to what is now Fairbank, which is only 3 miles down the San Pedro River from Charleston. I immediately went to work in the Dirk Gird Mill at Charleston. At that time, there was not enough water in Tombstone to mill the ore, so the big companies built their mills on the San Pedro. There were 5 big mills strung along the San Pedro from Charleston to the neighborhood of Contention. It was hot, as my friend had promised. I knew it was hot, but was getting along fine until one day I saw the thermometer. It was 124, and after that I felt the heat noticeably. Since then, I have laid off of thermometers. In proportion to its size, Charleston was a far tougher and livelier camp than Tombstone, which is only 9 miles away. There were 4 saloons going 24 hours daily. All kinds of gambling games operated continually. When paydays occurred at Fort Huachuca, many of the soldiers came to Charleston to drink. The soldiers of that time and their female friends were a pretty hard lot. Then would ensue some real heavyweight drinking and carousing. The law did not bother them as long as they paid their taxes. This tax on bawdy houses and saloons was set apart for the support of the public school system. It was the only support of the public school at that time. I soon got over my squeamishness. The saloons were somewhat small, and if a man's light went out during the night, he was usually stuck outside until the next day so as not to crowd those who remained. A man was occasionally blasted outside in the dark night by some enemy and would not be found until daybreak. Therefore, from 1883 until silver was demonetized in 1893, it was not an uncommon sight to see one or more dead men lying on the street when going to work on early morning shifts. If a dead man had a gun on him and was shot from the front, no one bothered to look for the killer. You must not think that everyone was tough or hard in Charleston those days. Gird seemed to have a preference for American, Irish, and Scotch assistants. Every Sunday, there was quite a procession of buckboards and buggies to the Catholic and Protestant churches in Tombstone. These were all steady, reliable, and religious families that would add respectability to any community, anywhere. I myself belonged to no church and never married. For many years, the Charleston Justice of the Peace was Jim Burnett. He dispensed justice, capital J please, on the dot and at any and all times. He was prompt and decisive and could and did hold court anywhere without the aid of a clerk, courtroom, law books, or sissy records. In addition, he never would entertain any appeals from any of his decisions. He always carried and could use a 45 with speed and precision, hence there was a vast amount of law and some semblance of order in his particular vicinity at all times. A man stole a horse from Mr. Curry, the father of the present head of the Apache Powder Company. Some days later, the man came into town with a train of wagons loaded with firewood and drawn by a long team of horses. Mr. Curry recognized his horse and proceeded to claim him. As he and the man argued, Judge Burnett happened along. "Is this your horse? Here, take him. I fine this man 9 cords of wood to be delivered to the Gird Mill," said the judge. Court had convened and adjourned all in one breath. The man had no show at all to argue. His wagons held 9 cords of wood exactly, as Judge Burnett's trained eyes well knew. The wood was delivered to the mill, and Judge Burnett was paid for it. On another occasion, the keeper of one of the resorts got drunk and loudmouthed. The judge and Charleston's lone constable proceeded there, and court opened and closed immediately by Burnett saying, "The fine will be $50. On being paid the fine, Judge Burnett sat into the poker game and lost the $50 in short order. One time a bunch of county officials came down from Tombstone and wanted to audit Judge Burnett's books. "Gentlemen, this is a self-sustaining office. I never ask anything from the county, and I never give the county anything," was Burnett's answer for an accounting. The Tombstone ores were fabulously rich, and even though the first crude smelter at Charleston lost large amounts of values in the process of smelting, the returns were immense. Gird was virtually broke financially when the strike was made, and he had to keep going with the equipment he had in order to acquire means to repay the sums he had borrowed to start his mine and build the smelter. Since then, the tailings and slag from the first mill had been reworked 5 times, each time at a profit, so rich was the original ore. The richness of the district had attracted gunmen, bandits, and crooks from all over the West and even the entire world. It was here at Charleston the crude ore was converted into shiny bars of rich metal. Naturally, it was here where the booty was greatest, the various gangs of hold-up artists came. Gird built an immense office building of adobe with walls almost 3 feet thick. In it, he installed an immense steel safe or vault to protect the precious bars while they awaited shipment to the United States Treasury. Inside of this building, the walls were papered with regular wallpaper to hide the ugliness of the adobe mud. As a matter of fact, the much-advertised safe never held the bar of the precious metal. It was only a bluff. Hiding places for the smelted bars had been dug out of various places in the walls and holes hidden with movable panels covered with the wallpaper like the rest of the room. The task of freighting the ore from Tombstone to Charleston was a problem in those days of small outfits. Finally, a man named Durkee took over that contract in a big way at a big price. At the end of the first year, his books showed an immense profit, so he decided to throw a party. He hired the biggest saloon in Charleston, bought all the liquor in the joint, and had more sent in from the railroad. The girl entertainers were engaged at a fixed price for the night. All the gaming tables were reinforced with huge stacks of freshly minted dollars. A large orchestra was brought in. Only working men were invited. In those days, both miners and freighters usually wore blue flannel shirts. Thus, a blue flannel shirt was the ticket of admittance. All the white-colored higher-ups, officials, bookkeepers, and tinhorns were barred from even approaching the place. It was a large night. Everything was free. When the crowd had finished off the imported wines and brandy and rum, they started in on common soldier whiskey. This class of whiskey was always sure to knock a man sideways at 60 yards without a miss. Then the fun began. As the men far outnumbered the hostesses, the latter complained they were being danced to death. The amateur croupiers and game tenders lost immense sums to the players. and joy reigned supreme until sometime after midnight. Then the freighters, who were mostly Texans, had to tell the others about the woes of their native state during the Reconstruction period. The miners, who were mostly Irish and English, advised them to forget it and enjoy the night. What? Forget Texas? No more dastardly proposition could be offered man. Thus the ruction started. Luckily, everyone had been searched for guns on entering earlier in the evening, but table legs, cuspidors, and bottles made punishing weapons in such hands. Finally, the Texans were heaved into the outer darkness, and the party was over. The next day, Durkee paid for the plate glass mirrors and other fixtures that suffered in the melee without any hesitation, but although he made a lot of money in future years, he never threw another party. And this concludes Early Days in Mining Town of Charleston. Sharon McGee's article is entitled The Selling of Geronimo. Soldiers strained against the enthusiastic milling crowds, arms locked to form a protective cordon around the dispirited band of Apaches, trudging through the early morning Florida streets. It was a show not equaled by any circus that ever traveled. Barnum would have gone into ecstasies over it, raved a reporter, watching the parade of warriors wrapped in colorful blankets, scantily clad young men, young women, smirking a little as with the consciousness of the attention they were attracting, children treadling along in childish innocence, and finally the old women carrying the baggage. It was April 1886, and Florida was getting its first glimpse of the tigers of the desert, the Apache prisoners of war. In August, the Niche Geronimo Band was surrendered, and the news flashed across the nation like a forest fire topping. The Apache terror was over, but for the utterly defeated Apaches, the humiliation and exploitation had just begun. Between April and October, five groups of more than 500 Chiricahua and Warm Springs Apaches made the sorrowful trip across the continent. As the special trains journeyed eastward, they often stopped, allowing the white eyes to peer at the infamous prisoners. The Apaches, staring back through soot-grimed windows, saw blurred white faces twisted in hatred, gaping mouths, spewing words they didn't understand, raised fists, shaking. Asa Dakluji, Geronimo's nephew, remembered, "Every time the train stopped, we expected to be taken off and killed." As they traveled farther east, however, the faces changed, became less angry, more curious. These white eyes wanted souvenirs, a desire the Apaches quickly capitalized on. Geronimo, the most famous of all the prisoners, was his own best PR man and an astute businessman. His possessions sold faster and for more money. When he exhausted his supply, he gathered up items belonging to his warriors, said the Pensacola Commercial. He'd then exhibit himself to the anxious memento seekers, ostentatiously taking off the article and hand it to the purchaser. Dakluji rationalized, he didn't tell anybody he made them. People just assumed he did. Sometimes Geronimo lost patience with the rude, staring white eyes. Often clad only in a breechcloth, he was made to stand on the platform between cars before the gawking crowds. Once, apparently disgruntled, he hefted a foot and propped it against the side of the car, providing the spectators an up-close and very personal view of the notorious war leader. Another time, a reporter entered the car where Geronimo slept, thinking to bribe him for a story with a cigar from the handful he carried. Geronimo opened one sleepy eye, grabbed all the cigars, and turned away. The ripped-off reporter meekly left the train with nary a quote. Although the Southwest screamed for Apache blood, the East welcomed its reluctant visitors with open arms. Dollar signs, visions of swarming tourists, and the resultant economic boost beckoned. A war of words broke out, with close to 500 Apaches already crammed into tiny Fort Marion at St. Augustine. Pensacolians started a petition to have the Niche Geronimo Band incarcerated at Fort Pickens on Santa Rosa Island in Pensacola Bay. The painted demons, the petitioners said, would be a better card than a circus or sea serpent and give Pensacola an attraction which will bring her many visitors. The Florida Times Union, speaking for St. Augustine, rebutted, "Geronimo is the man we want here." Pensacola persevered, and the Pensacolian proudly stated, the government has selected the most suitable place to incarcerate the greatest living American general and his principal officers. We welcome the nation's distinguished guests. Geronimo's presence was so coveted that years later, reputable St. Augustinians swore he'd graced their fair city. One longtime resident said Geronimo was among the Apaches who often squatted in her courtyard and ate ice cream. Another said she had been grabbed by Geronimo, and only the quick intervention of the soldiers saved her from an unspeakable fate. And the Bishop of Haiti would recall that he was the only male person in whose hair Geronimo had had his hand without taking a scalp. When the bishop was a boy, he said, Geronimo reached between cell bars and stroked his blonde hair. While Geronimo was allegedly eating ice cream, grabbing young girls, and tousling golden curls, he and his warriors were, in actuality, leading a sideshow existence at Fort Pickens. Excursion boats left Pensacola daily, and tourists intruded into every facet of the Apaches' lives. It was one-stop shopping at its best. You can go over to Santa Rosa Island, see Fort Pickens and Geronimo, and gather beautiful shells and marine curiosities on the beach, stated the Pensacola commercial. On a record day, 459 Pensacolians made the trip. Groupies flourished, a reporter chided regular female visitors. The ladies who visit these savages indulged in too much gush, said another. We confess our lack of sympathy with the kind of mentality that makes much of murderers and cutthroats. One breathless young thing asked a soldier, Can you tell me what is best for me to give to Geronimo? He answered, An ounce of lead between the eyes. This feminine attention didn't go unnoticed. An observer noted, Geronimo recalls the names of several ladies who have paid more than one visit. The attention paid the visitors rankled some. A cartoon captioned, Tired of Murder, a Siesta in Florida, ran in Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper. In it, Geronimo lounges in a hammock, smoking a cigar, liquor bottle at hand, while being fanned by Uncle Sam. The Pensacolian stated, Geronimo and his band got fat in Florida and were well pleased with their punishment. And in San Antonio, the media reported, the bloodthirsty villains are gazed at, covered with given flowers and delicacies as if they were heroes. Contrary to this supposed life of leisure and luxury, the Apaches suffered both mentally and physically. They were homesick for Arizona and felt certain a death sentence dangled dangerously close over their heads. Malaria and tuberculosis decimated their ranks. Finally, the government moved both groups to what was considered a healthier climate, Mount Vernon, Alabama. St. Augustine and Pensacola cried foul. The poor Indians silently packed their tents and stole away in the dark hours of the night, penned a St. Augustinian writer. The Pensacolian said, Just think of it, our big engine and large-sized curiosity, Geronimo, together with those held with him at Fort Pickens, were conveyed to Mobile. Alabama, of course, was delighted. The placing of the Indians at Mount Vernon will add greatly to the attractiveness of that place as a Sunday school picnic resort, reported the Mobile Register, while railroad officials proclaimed, Mount Vernon will become a favorite summer resort. Excursions from as far away as New Orleans visited Apache Village. The docility and friendliness of the Apaches disappointed many. That Geronimo taught Sunday school, acted as justice of the peace, and kept discipline in the schoolroom seemed incongruous. After observing Geronimo, the Northwestern lumberman said he was about as mild-mannered a man as ever scuttled a ship or cut a throat, and for that matter butchered defenseless women and children. In 1894, the government moved the Apaches permanently to Fort Sill, Indian Territory, Oklahoma. But by then, disease had taken its toll. Less than 300 Apaches remained, most of them children born in captivity. While the intense curiosity lessened, one thing remained constant. Geronimo was in demand, a saleable commodity. He made many personal appearances, including the Omaha Exposition and the St. Louis World's Fair. He came close to stealing Teddy Roosevelt's thunder when he appeared in the new president's inaugural parade. Heading a delegation of Indian leaders, Geronimo rode in full face paint, head held high, without a flicker of emotion showing on his creased face. He wore only a breechcloth, moccasins, and his medicine hat. a cap of eagle feathers with streaming eagle plumes, which hung below his stirrups. The cheers for Roosevelt evaporated. Men threw their hats into the air and shouted, "Hooray for Geronimo!" Doc Lugie, acting as Geronimo's segundo, said, "We were told later that Roosevelt said he never wished to hear the name of Geronimo again." This fame, along with the proclivity for making a buck, ensured Geronimo's pockets always jingled. He sold anything anyone wanted to buy. His photo and autograph were always for sale. He once sold a ragged hawk feather plucked from the ground for $5. On trips, he'd cut the buttons from his coat and sell them for 25 cents each. His hat went for $5. He'd then sew on new buttons and don a new hat. He had had the foresight to bring along extras and eagerly await the next stop. Of his trip to the World's Fair, he said, "I often made as much as $2 a day, and when I returned, I had plenty of money, more than I had ever owned before." When he died, he had more than $10,000 in his bank account. Today, interest in the Apaches remains high. There is understanding, compassion, and respect for these people who fought so fiercely and valiantly to save their homeland and, because of this, were doomed to a sideshow existence. Feelings about Geronimo, however, remain mixed. But no matter whether you think of him as a villain or a folk hero, one fact is undeniable. As one official so succinctly said, he is the only Geronimo. And this concludes the selling of Geronimo. Don Dodera writes about Arizona dust. No tank or car can do without this awful stuff. Not to take anything away from a 500,000 proud American veterans, but 1991's Operation Desert Storm to liberate Kuwait was won single-handedly by Joseph Prophet in 1942. Not only did Prophet decide a war a half century before it began, he helped to create a product that became a global standard and launched a small but thriving Arizona industry. The product, Arizona Dust, used the world around for testing filters, torturing machinery, and infiltrating electronic equipment. At this writing, to lend credence to his claim, Joe Prophet was still on hand to testify from his retirement home in Sun City. At 99, Joe expected to continue bragging, a bit tongue-in-cheek, about Arizona dust well into his second century. Said he, "It was and is wonderful and awful stuff." The origin of this awful wonderfulness dates to early World War II when the U.S. Army invaded North Africa to take on the armored forces of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, Germany's Desert Fox. Within days, American tankers realized their greatest enemy was Africa's Sahara Desert. The combat life of our tracked vehicles averaged half an hour. More were put out of action by dust and hostile fire. In Detroit, General Motors automotive experts, makers of military engines, were summoned to secret emergency sessions. Then a leading GM engineer, Prophet, recalled, "We were losing engines faster than we could make them. We decided to go to Arizona where we knew the dust was bad. We gained permission to use a piece of the Pima Reservation south of Phoenix, Gila River Indian Reservation, and hired some cowboys to herd experimental tanks around a quarter-mile circle. The lead tanks picked up a huge dust cloud. Following them, our test drivers drove blind. They knew they were on course when they couldn't see a thing. We found that if one bolt was loose or if there was the slightest crack in the tank armor, dust would pour in like the very devil. The big M4 tank was equipped with 6 air cleaners. They had trapped 90 pounds of dust in 56 miles, but 9 pounds entered the engine. Soon we improved air filters to 99.6% efficiency, and in its own way, Arizona dust helped win the war." Rules for Arizona dust did not end with the big one. Now, as a trademark item, Arizona dust gained acceptance as a standard by industries making electrical parts, automotive components, ventilation systems, and armaments. Space hardware, atomic devices, and modern electronics thereafter were subjected to the rigors of Arizona dust. Prior to battle with Iraqi forces, doomsayers predicted that Allied equipment would be defeated by the Shamal, the notorious sandstorms of the Arabian Peninsula. Dusty, blinding winds could ground Allied warplanes and halt troop movements for hours or even days at a time. Stinging sand, as fine as talcum powder, can clog air filters, overheat the engines on military vehicles and aircraft, scratch and erode rotor blades and other moving parts, and jam sensitive weaponry, and so on. But solutions for most of these things had already passed muster with Arizona dust, and Desert Storm succeeded. For Arizona, one bonus of early vehicular research is the proliferation of automotive test tracks in the state. Among the first was the 5,000-acre GM Proving Ground near Apache Junction. Today, some 400 full-time employees test GM vehicles, parts, and paints in the desert environment. Also given extensive Arizona tests are products from Ford, Chrysler, Volvo, Nissan, Jaguar, and Toyota. Many use jars of Arizona dust. The clay-free earth continues to be harvested from the original site whenever needed, usually in the dry season of May and June, at the direction of Pima tribal leaders. Indian workers quarry Arizona dust. It's shifted into steel drums. The Indian nation is paid a fee for each collection. The grit is shipped to Powder Technologies, Inc. of Minneapolis, where it is processed and distributed to test facilities around the world. At first, Arizona dust sold for $2.50 a pound. Today, the dust is still a bargain, costing no more than $3.75 a pound when bought by the jar, and as low as $3.07 per pound when bought by the 55-gallon drum. And this concludes Arizona dust. No tank or car can do without this awful stuff. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.